From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. How important is Southern cooking to you?
I keep hot sauce in my bag, just in case some fried chicken pops off. And I try to regulate myself, but it's a work in progress. It's like somebody who's trying to get off of like crack or heroin or something. I'm trying to wean myself off fried chicken, man.
The struggle is real. Today we'll hear from a panel of food writers about what they think is the quintessential Bible of Southern cooking. That's coming up. First, yesterday was Valentine's Day, and we asked you for your romance or anti-romance stories. Here are your first thoughts. Della from Decatur called us to reveal her husband's love-hate relationship with Valentine's Day.
My husband has always been very romantic, but he kind of bucked the idea that you should tell him to be romantic on this single day. He made me a hand-drawn card. It was a Batman holding a little rose, and it was kind of his little middle finger to Valentine's Day.
Thanks, Stella. On Twitter, Joel Cook says, quote, I will be married 21 years in July. My wife and I knew each other for 6 weeks. Stupid kids. I was 19. She was 20. We are stubborn. End quote. We love getting your stories. Call us like Della did at 404-500-9457 or tweet us like Joel did. We're at OST Talk, and we might feature your comments on the show. Views about climate change vary greatly between Presidents Obama and Trump. Before he was elected president, Donald Trump called climate change a hoax. In the Obama administration, the White House had a web page dedicated to climate change. Now a new energy policy page on the White House website makes zero reference to climate change or global warming. We reached out to the White House to find where the administration stands on climate change and got no response. There is a major climate change conference tomorrow in Atlanta. It's at the Carter Center. But that's only because it was canceled by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The CDC has not responded to our request for a comment on that cancellation. Georges Benjamin is the executive director of the American Public Health Association and one of the organizers of the climate change conference. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us. Also with us is Peter Dykstra. He's the publisher of Environmental Health News, and he joins me by Skype from his home in Conyers. Hi there, Peter.
Hi.
So, Dr. B, why was the conference canceled at the CDC?
You know, I think basically the CDC got cold feet, you know, with the new administration coming in and people being very concerned about climate change in that administration, that if they continued to have it, that it would get canceled from under them, and people would be stuck with airline tickets and hotel rooms, and they thought they ought to just wait and see what the new administration had to say before they had a conference.
I want to just settle something right at the beginning before we continue, and that's the so-called debate over climate change, which I want to be clear is not a scientific debate. But here is then, at this point, still candidate, not yet president, Donald Trump, in an interview with the Miami Herald, and he's dismissing research behind climate change.
Many years ago, I believe it was in the 1920s, they talked about the phenomena of global cooling. They thought the planet was getting cooler. Now they think the planet is getting warmer. Nobody knows for sure. Nobody knows for sure.
Peter, nobody knows for sure. Can you answer that?
I want to speak specifically to the global cooling nonsense because that's just got to go away. I'm going to turn 60 years old next month. The possibility of global cooling was raised in the scientific community about 2 weeks before my senior prom. You know, we've been in the Beyonce and Jay-Z era. That is from the Captain and Tennille equivalent era of science. It's long been dismissed. It's a durable talking point. These things often don't die through climate denial. And it's alarming to see climate denial alive in the cabinet, in charge of House and Senate committees, and in the White House. We're the only country in that status in the world, the only one.
Okay, so why, George, why are you addressing climate change as a public health issue? How is climate change affecting health?
Yeah, it's true. Climate change is here, as you just heard. It is dramatically affecting our health. More people are having asthma attacks. Big heat waves put our health at risk. A warming environment brings vector-borne diseases closer to home than ever before. And just think about the severe storms and the number of people that have been injured or killed with the increasing frequency and severity of the storms that we're having. If it hurt people or kills people, it's ours. And that's why the public health community is concerned about climate change and our health.
Another thing that the National Climate Assessment pointed to were respiratory problems and then this possible spread of disease because of insects. What is that danger?
Well, think about it. You know, we know, for example, mosquito-borne diseases. We just spent a whole year worrying about Zika. And, of course, that's a mosquito-borne disease. And the fact that as the weather gets warmer and wetter, you'll have more mosquitoes. So things like West Nile virus and dengue and Zika and other mosquito-borne diseases vector-borne diseases are more likely to happen in those communities.
So, Peter, let me play you another comment from the president, because I assume that one of the reasons Dr. Benjamin described the CDC as getting cold feet is because it appears that the new administration under Donald Trump may be against funding any climate research. So let's hear from the new president again. This is from his interview with the Miami Herald in August.
Certainly climate has changed. You know, they used to call it global warming. They've had many different, they call it extreme weather. They always change the name to encapsulate everything. The problem we have is our businesses are suffering. Our businesses are unable to compete in this country because other countries aren't being forced to do what our businesses are being forced to do.
Okay, he makes two arguments there, Peter. Let's deal with the first one, which is his idea that they're constantly changing the name.
Climate change and global warming have been used interchangeably for a long time. It's not a conspiracy. There are different ways to define not what's going to happen, but what's already happening. And there's been an effort to paint this alleged name change as some sort of conspiracy theory. Looking at the science, that just doesn't wash. One metaphor I like to present about this is back during the days of the ill-conceived Iraq invasion and Iraq war, Dick Cheney, the vice president, put forth a theory that even if there's a 1% chance that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, they didn't, but even if there's a 1% chance, we have to take decisive action. The denial is so deep that it seems we're denying even a 1% chance that what the vast majority of the scientific community in the world is telling us is true. And it could be extremely costly to the business community, to the general public, and to folks who live along the shoreline in places like Mar-a-Lago.
So then let me put the second half of Donald Trump's comments to you, Dr. Benjamin, because it sounds like he's saying we can't, even if climate change is a threat to public health, we can't put regulations on because that will make it impossible for our businesses to compete. What's your response to that?
If you're dead, you can't have a business. If you're sick, you can't have a business. It's nonsense. You know, first of all, the green industry, which is rapidly growing and creating jobs, is a very important component of our emerging economy. Secondly, there are many things that we can do to reduce your own individual carbon footprint. Business community, by the way, is not buying this. The business community has already adopted the fact that we need to adjust for climate change, and it's actively working in that area. But the fact of the matter is that we need to make sure that the air is safe to breathe and the water is safe to drink. Otherwise, there's really no reason to have a business because we'll be too sick in our environment.
So, Peter, let's maybe talk about what we spoke of a moment ago, which is why this was canceled at the CDC and the Carter Center had to step forward. And part of that was through the aegis of former Vice President Al Gore. I'm going to play you this comment from, it was actually a back and forth between Republican Congressman Ryan Zinke of Montana and Senator Bernie Sanders. Ryan Zinke is now the nominee to be Interior Secretary, and it sounds as though he is breaking ranks with Donald Trump. Here's that exchange.
I don't believe it's a hoax. I believe we should.
You do not believe it's a hoax.
No, I believe we should be prudent to be prudent. That means I don't know definitively. There's a lot of debate on both sides of the aisle.
Well, actually, there's not a whole lot of debate now. The scientific community is virtually unanimous that climate change is real.
But, Peter, what kind of fear is there among the scientific community that there could be censorship, especially in light of some of the ways in which federal scientists have been silenced or at least threatened with silence in the past few weeks?
Well, and web pages have disappeared. Climate scientists being threatened or harassed or sued or Freedom of Information Act requested within an inch of their lives is nothing new. This has been going on for a long time. I don't think folks are aware of just exactly how much political, ideological, possibly financial pressure the science community is under for just doing its job on these issues. And by the way, the Carter Center conference, the folks I work for, weren't all that interested in covering it. They only asked me to go attend and report on the conference after the CDC backed out. So I think the tactic of backing out of this conference may backfire.
Let me put the same question then to you, Dr. Benjamin. Do you feel as though there is a fear among the scientific community that there could be backlash for this kind of research?
Yes, the fear is there. But, you know, one of the things that you know when you've been in public health, and as long as I have, is that fearing something doesn't mean that the problems aren't going to go away. Bad news does not get better with time. So a warming environment, the fact that we have emerging infectious diseases, the fact that we have severe weather is going to be here even if we pretend that climate change doesn't exist and is here today. And we're going to have to respond to it. So no matter what you call it, whether you have to call it emergency response to severe weather or emergency response to emerging infectious diseases. Climate change certainly is here, and we're going to have to respond. And by the way, this administration, as if they're serious about protecting the health and well-being of the American people, don't have to worry about little terrorists coming into the country, because Mother Nature, Father Nature is a terrible terrorist, and we're seeing that with climate change.
Well, Peter, is there a possibility that this is just part of the transition of a regular administration, that some of these fears may be unfounded, and that, in fact, there won't be censorship of scientists and things will move forward as they have been for the past decade?
As Dr. Benjamin said, there's a lot happening in the business community and with clean energy that will be beyond the grasp of this administration. But I don't see much doubt, and I don't see much hope that this administration gets the message. If this were a year back and I had told you that the CEO of ExxonMobil, a 41-year career Exxon employee who presided over a company that funded pseudoscience and climate denial, was going to be our Secretary of State. I don't think you would have taken me seriously, first of all, but that certainly doesn't present a picture of hope that the United States is going to join the rest of the world community in being serious about climate change.
Dr. Benjamin, do scientists need the U.S. government? Can this research, especially into climate change as a public health threat, move forward regardless of what the Trump administration decides?
Well, it's best to have the federal government as a partner here. They're obviously a major funding source, and some of the best scientists in the world are in the federal government. You know, there's Department of Defense agencies that are doing climate change research because they have to do that in order to defend this country. So this is not something that they can put their head in the sand and pretend is not going to happen. They're going to have to be involved in climate change, whether they like it or not.
That is Georges Benjamin of the American Public Health Association. He will be the keynote speaker at a climate change conference tomorrow at the Carter Center. And we also heard from Peter Dykstra of Environmental Health News. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Just ahead, the fictional story of a Holocaust survivor who travels to Savannah. First, though, prep the kitchen, because we're talking about the best Southern cookbooks. This is On Second Thought. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Many couples celebrated Valentine's Day with a meal. Food is an integral part of the South's identity, and we are paying homage this year to Southern cuisine. It's a series we call Georgia Eats. A lot of chefs and food writers, and maybe even more cooks, know the name Mrs. S.R. Dull. Henrietta. She was longtime editor of the home economics page of the Atlanta Journal. And in 1928, she wrote the book Southern Cooking, which has been described as the Bible of Southern cooking. And that got us wondering if there are other cookbooks that actually might challenge Mrs. S.R. Dull for that title. We're joined now by Savannah food writer Damon Fowler. Hi, Damon.
Hi.
And we also have Judith Winfrey, president of the Atlanta-based company Peach Dish. Hi there.
Hello.
And also joining me from Denver, Colorado, is Adrian Miller, who's a self-defined soul food scholar. Hey, Adrian.
Hey, good to be with you.
That makes you laugh, but what does soul food scholar mean?
Oh, it's a self-appointed title, so it just means that I drop knowledge like hot biscuits.
And you have an excuse for eating fried chicken. That's what it sounds like to me.
Absolutely.
All right, so let's start with the idea of a Bible for Southern food. Who has used Mrs. S.R. Dahl's cookbook? Any of the three of you?
I certainly have. Mm-hmm. My copy of Mrs. Dahl's was given to me by my mother, who used it for many years and then handed it down to me. And I use it not so much for cooking, but more for historical reference when I'm looking for ideas or for reference points about Southern food at a certain time. I will look to Mrs. Dahl's.
So, Adrian, what would constitute, what would make something a Bible of Southern food? What needs to be in that book?
I think it needs to just really explore the breadth of Southern cooking and bring in a lot of different regional elements. And it needs to be something that's cookable. I think something that a home cook can actually take in their kitchen and use. And much like Judith, I used it when I was writing my book on the history of soul food as a historical reference because I really wanted to put some soul food in context. And I thought it was important to really know foundationally what was Southern cooking. And I think Dahl's cookbook does that.
So, Damon, I tried a few recipes in Henrietta Dahl's cookbook, and I think that what Judith and Damon are referring to, I mean, what Judith and Adrian are referring to is that it's not easy to reproduce her recipes. Is that why maybe the cookbook is not the Bible?
I think for cooks it's not. I think for people who you know, have cooked for years, because Mrs. Dahl used a shorthand. Her recipes are nowadays considered very old-fashioned because she was writing for an audience who grew up with a grandmother who cooked or who grew up with a black cook in their kitchen who cooked. And so they had a reference. And so Mrs. Dahl didn't waste a lot of time reiterating those references. So her recipes are almost skeletal. But if you have that kind of background, then you don't have any trouble with the
if you're
the,
a chef and not a cook, maybe.
Well, if you're a cook, I professional chefs don't always have exactly the same reference, but I think they wouldn't have any trouble with her book. I actually use it some and used it more when I was doing research for my first book, because Mrs. Dahl was a transition between the Old South and the New South. And she was 65 years old when that book was published, so she was at the age of retirement, but she didn't retire for another 20 years.
Yeah.
So she was really a remarkable woman. And one of the things I find remarkable about this book is that it was so forward-looking. There are frozen salads in it. There's a wonderful savory tomato sherbet in it that she even has scooped into an avocado. It sounds very contemporary.
So let's move on to another chef and cookbook that many people cite as being a Bible, and weigh this. This is the voice of Edna Lewis. She learned to cook watching her mother, and her book was called The Taste of Country Cooking. This is one of the sections is called First Berries, Emancipation Day, about dinner in the fall. And this is her comment from an interview she did with NPR.
A lot of people carried roast chicken, which was a chicken that had become of age and you no longer could fry. And, of course, pork and fall greens like turnip greens or mustard greens and sweet potatoes and pickles and preserves, and yeast bread.
So, Judith, this is a book that you looked at as a kind of Bible. Why?
Well, I think Mrs. Lewis had such a deep and connected appreciation of Southern food. I mean, her sense of Southern food was more than just about ingredients and preparations. It was about agriculture, and it was about seasonality. And if you look to some of the leaders of this new Southern cuisine that we see in restaurants today, she was the high priestess for many of those chefs. chefs, including Scott Peacock and his heirs to the throne, Stephen Satterfield, Billy Allen here in Atlanta, Bill Neal in North Carolina. I think a lot of people, mostly men, that we consider great Southern chefs, looked
inspired
to
by
Ms.
this
Lewis.
Woman.
Yes.
Well, then let me put this to you, Adrian, because one thing that you have written about is the aspect of Southern food, which is about sort of using everything and being very versatile in your ingredients. So let's hear Edna Lewis again. She grew up in the farming community of Freetown, Virginia. So again, this is from her interview in 1983.
But you had cows and pigs and chickens, and you utilize the composted manures of the animals, which enrich the soil. Of course, they added other ingredients like wood ashes and lime to help sweeten the soil, and the vegetables and the corn grew on its own steam without the boost from fertilizer.
So how important is that sort of using everything attitude to Southern cooking, Adrian?
Oh, it's very important because it shows the genius of these cooks. And it's such a contrast to the cooking we do today, which can often be so wasteful. But it's very empowering also because utilizing all of these ingredients and figuring out creative ways to kind of spread the wealth, so to say, helped feed a large community, especially when people had scarce resources and had to make things stretch. It's just the genius of these Southern cooks. And I love the taste of country cooking because of the narrative aspect it gives. It puts this food in context and gives you a rich sense of agricultural life in the rural South. It's just a beautifully written book.
Damon, how important is that? When we're talking about a Bible for Southern cooking, how important is the balance between the recipes themselves and what Adrian just mentioned, that narrative?
Well, I think one of the things that's so lovely about Edna's writing and I get a little emotional hearing her voice again. I haven't heard it for years. And that narrative is very important, and I think it's important to have context, especially now. You know, when I said before, Mrs. Dahl had a reference with the recipe so she could be brief with them. She could abbreviate because people knew what she was talking about. But nowadays, we've lost that. We've also lost that sense of context. So having things like Edna's lucid, beautiful narrative helps us to recover that context and to understand it in a visceral way, because we don't have people like Edna anymore.
You chose as one of your favorite cookbooks, surprisingly to me at least, an Italian cookbook. How is the Italian cooking related to Southern cooking?
Well, people always sort of look at me as if I have two heads when I start talking about that. When I was studying architecture, I was lucky enough to go to Italy, and it was Italian cooking that really brought me home to Southern food again. Because after I got used to the idea that I was having things I'd never had every single day that I was there, everything was so familiar to me. There was an approach to flavor. There was an approach to using that thing that Edna talks about using everything, wasting nothing. That's a very Italian thing as well. So I felt at home. I just felt like I was coming back full circle. And it was eventually Marcella Hazan, from her cookbooks, that I learned so much about cooking. But then she's the one who really brought me home again. She said, if you really want to do something important, you have to explore your own roots. You have to go back to those roots. And, you know, one of the things that, if I could very quickly, one of the things that Marcella says in her first cookbook is the most useful thing to know about Italian cooking is that as such it doesn't exist. It's actually a collection of regional cuisines. I think that is very true of the South. I think that Southern cooking is a collection of regional cuisines. And the problem with trying to name a book an encyclopedia or a Bible of Southern cooking is that you're inevitably going to put boundaries around what you're defining as Southern food.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Savannah-based food writer Damon Fowler, who you just heard, Denver-based food historian Adrian Miller, and Judith Winfrey of Atlanta-based Peach Dish, which is a food delivery service that focuses on Southern cuisine especially. And we have Edward Austin Hall tweeted us, Eugene Walter wrote the only Bible for our regional cuisine that I swear by, which is a cookbook called American Cooking Southern Style. And we had another listener who said, I'd be very interested to learn about vegan Southern food cookbooks. And I'm sorry, Veronica, there aren't a lot of the Bibles of supposed Bibles of Southern cuisine that don't use any meat or bacon or pork or lard. So that one's difficult. Although if any of you, three of you, have a recommendation for a vegan Southern food book...
I have one for vegan soul food. In fact, vegan soul food is one of the hottest trends in soul food. And Vegan Soul Kitchen by Chef Bryant Terry is a definite one. Or Afro-Caribbean Vegan is another one.
So then let me go to another chef and another cookbook that at least one of you has named as being particularly influential. This is James Beard Award-winning food writer Natalie Dupree, and she's talking here about a particular dish she makes that's very popular.
I make a lot of gratin. You just slice your turnips, blanch them if they're really hard and woody, but now they should be smaller and sweeter. You slice them up and you sprinkle them with salt and pepper and maybe pour over some chicken stock or heavy cream, and then you can bake them in the oven about half an hour.
Judith, you mentioned this particular cookbook and Natalie Dupree's writing as being influential. Why?
Well, she's another, in my opinion, high priestess of Southern food. She has talked about it, written about it, had television shows about it for years and years. And for me, I was born in the 70s. Natalie Dupree was one of the first women or one of the first people that I knew who was out there putting Southern food up as something to celebrate, something to appreciate, something to explore.
So then we have about 3.5 minutes left, and I feel like that's just enough time to ask the essential question here. So I'll address it to each of the three of you in turn. And let me start with you, Adrian. What then are the characteristics of Southern food? What makes a dish Southern?
Well, I think, first of all, using local ingredients to the South. I think traditionally it's been flavoring it with some kind of meat. That used to be pork for a long time, but people are using smoked turkey. But nowadays, as people are getting more health conscious, they're using spices and other things to get that flavor profile. And of course, a lot of Southern cooks will tell you that they have to you have to include love while you're cooking and serving up that dish.
Okay, then let's move on to love, possibly bacon.
Aren't they the same thing?
Yeah.
Damon, what would you say characterizes Southern cuisine?
You know, I think Adrian has done a pretty good job of what I would say. It's close to the land. It's, of course, things that are available in this area. It's deeply rooted in history, but it's moving forward. At the same time, so we're seeing the vegan soul food, for heaven's sake. Who would have thought? So I think that close to the land, the earthiness, the you know, family is so important in the South. I think it's true everywhere, and that's one of the things I saw as being parallel with Southern, with Italian cooking, is that family was so important. So I think that element of love is key.
Okay, so then Judith, let me go to you. Family, love, it's a lot of emotion then wrapped up in Southern cooking, maybe?
Yeah, I certainly think there's emotion. I certainly think there's connection, connectivity. The connection to the land is essential. Love is a connecting factor among people and between people. I would add that technologically, it's relatively simple. You don't need a lot of fancy gadgets. If you have a cast iron skillet and a hearth, you can do most everything you need to do with Southern food.
I hadn't thought about that, but that's very true.
Yeah.
Yeah, you need a mixing bowl and a cast iron skillet, and you're basically done. So we have about a minute left, so let me do one more round robin question, which is if you're a transplant to Georgia, as so many people are, and you want to learn Southern cooking, what's the first cookbook I pick up? Judith?
Well, this one is a little bit of a twist, but I think it's fun because it's a modern take on Southern food from current voices, and it's the Southern Foodways Alliance Community Cookbook.
Okay, Damon?
Oh, goodness. I have to choose.
Yep. Do it fast. We got 15 seconds.
I would say Natalie's. I would say Natalie's New Southern Cooking.
Okay, and then to Adrian.
I'm so unoriginal, but I'm going to echo both of those choices. Those were the two that were floating in my mind.
Fair enough. That is Denver-based food historian Adrian Miller, soul food scholar, also Savannah-based food writer Damon Fowler, and Judith Winfrey of Atlanta-based Peach Dish. Thanks so much to all three of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Just ahead, I speak with Jonathan Rabb, who's one of the featured writers at this week's Savannah Book Festival. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Tomorrow, we're all about books. In honor of the Savannah Book Festival this weekend, we'll dedicate a full hour to conversations with authors. We'll also talk about why adults are reading less and less these days. So, be part of that discussion. Tell us, what are you reading? And do you read on hardbacks, ebooks, or audiobooks? Do you read at all? Call us at 404-500-9457, and then be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. Millions of Jews died in the Holocaust. Many survivors were forced to find new homes, make new lives on foreign shores in the aftermath of the war. Author Jonathan Rabb explores this very difficult transition in his new novel, Among the Living. The book is set in 1947 when concentration camp survivor Itzhak Golden travels to Savannah. His new life in Georgia demands that he face complex divisions within Savannah's Jewish community. Author Jonathan Rabb will be a featured writer at the 2017 Book Festival this weekend, and he joined us last fall to talk about his book.
Good morning.
I have to be honest with you that when they handed me this book to read for this interview, the first thing I thought was, oh, God, another novel about Holocaust survivors. But I was surprised because what you have landed on is a subject that I just don't think I've ever read about before, which is the difficulty that survivors had even relating with their own Jewish community, that even among the Jews, they didn't know what to say to survivors. How did you come to this particular subject matter?
Well, it's funny. I mean, so many people have said it's a Holocaust novel. I don't look at it that way. I moved down to Savannah, and just I'd like to say I hope everybody in Savannah and the path of Matthew today is safe. But we moved down to Savannah, and you know, I didn't know anything about Southern Jewry at the time. I'd grown up in the Northeast, and so I felt like an outsider. So I needed to bring a character there who also didn't know anything about Southern Jewry, and it just made sense to me to bring someone at that time, I've always done historical fiction, to a place where there was a fractured Jewish community. And yes, his experience is the Holocaust in the past, but it's someone who is trying to find his way through that. And when he gets to Savannah, this division in the Jewish community between the Reform and Conservative is sort of absurd to him. Because these sorts of things don't make sense. And even a character in the book at one point says, we know this must be absurd to you, but it's who we are. And finding the difficulty in explaining an experience that no one who didn't go through that experience could have, whether they were Jew or non-Jew, is going to make it very, very difficult for him. And that's why later in the book, I bring in another character who has survived a concentration camp as well, and she is a very, very different voice. He is able to find his way through. I mean, he does come back to the living. She, I'm not so sure. And she has a very powerful line at one point where she says to him in the book, these people will never understand you, and you will never understand them. And she doesn't say it to demean, to in any kind of judgmental
way.
It's the truth.
Yeah.
And, you know, part of the choice
and
for
him. And he doesn't argue with her either.
No, of course not. Of course not. But he's been there longer than she has. And, of course, he has found someone in the Jewish community, although he's in the conservative community, the woman he falls
yeah,
in
like
love
a
with
Romeo
is
reformed.
Sure, sure, sure.
Yeah.
My wife was very happy that I finally in one of my books have a love story, although I made it tough on him, so that's just me. But, you know, he has a very different experience. But, you know, I had a cousin who, in fact, I dedicate the book to my great uncle and aunt and cousin who all miraculously survived the war. And my cousin was only 9 years old when he was in a camp. And I would see him from moved to New York. He was there. And we would have breakfast many, many mornings. And he was an accountant. He was living a normal life. But you could see that there was something, obviously, that was still shattered inside. And
this part was very interesting to me because nobody knows what to say to him, Itzhak. It's almost as though he himself doesn't know what they should be saying. But that doesn't necessarily have to be the Holocaust. It just reminded me of pretty much anyone who's lived through a horrific tragedy of some kind.
Any kind of trauma. What do you suppose? And you have your sort of list of things. There's a scene in the book where people start asking him, what was it like? And internally, he's thinking to himself, you know, all right, here are the questions. I'll answer them the way I usually do. And at a certain point, they get to the question. And inside, in his head, he says, here it comes. I know it's going to come. And the question always is, how could you have not known? How could you have not gotten out? And, you know, that, I think, is one of the questions that people always ask of people going through traumas. And I always bring up the example of, I was living in New York with my wife in 2001, and walking down the streets in August, none of us were thinking to ourselves, gosh, you know, in about a month, the whole world is going to change. You're not aware of these epic things that are going on, and history just sort of moves you along. How could you not know? How could you not get out? It's almost a nonsensical question at a certain point, and yet you have to answer it. And, you know, he's still just trying to find his way. And I think you sort of turn on an automatic pilot at a certain point to confront those kinds of questions. I think, at least he did. That was the character I created.
How did you go about figuring that out, though? I mean, what kind of research do you do to get inside the mind of a trauma victim? Because I've never been through that kind of trauma.
Sure.
But so I would have no idea what that experience would be like.
Well, I mean, obviously, I projected a lot onto my cousin, who was my father's generation. And, you know, but this was years ago. I had the idea to write a book with him as, not him, but a character like that. But I was living in New York at the time, and it just seemed too obvious to set this kind of story in New York. When we moved down to Savannah about 8 years ago, and as I said, I needed an outsider, suddenly there was this confluence of ideas that I'd had for a long time, and they came together. You know, projecting onto someone I knew, but also there are many, many beautiful books out there. I'm a huge fan of, if one can be, but I think he's a beautiful writer, is Primo Levi. And his, you know, Survival in Auschwitz and any number of the books, both fiction and nonfiction, are extraordinary because you read these books, especially Survival in Auschwitz, and there isn't an element of judgment going on. And that to me is fascinating. He simply depicts what it was like to be in that concentration camp very, very vividly. But he never takes out, you know, his knife to take back against the Nazis. It's extraordinary what he could do. And it's this wonderful stillness within him. And I wanted to give that to my character, which means he's a very quiet character. And that was the bigger challenge, because in fiction, people want big, you know, characters that dominate a scene. And he's not that. And
we never get the full story of what happened to him either.
No, and I don't think anybody ever will. Even the woman I don't want to give anything away, but, you know, the woman he falls in love with, she never fully finds out. And I think it's a sweet moment between them where She says to him at one point, she said, I always thought that you didn't speak that much because of the language. But no, you're wonderful at English. It's something else. And that's true. And yet he is able to open up to her in some ways. But I think opening up about those things fully means you have to relive them fully. And I don't think anybody wants to do that, especially him.
If you're just joining us, my guest is author Jonathan Rabb. His new novel is called Among the Living. It's set in Savannah after World War II. There's a lot of resonances to this story. First of all, we get in a racism with the African-American characters that are in there. What kind of research did you have to do to recreate Savannah of 1947?
Well, it's one of the most fun I've ever had because in my books, the previous books that I'd done, it take place in Berlin in 1919, 27, Spain in 36. You know, there are people I could have interviewed, but no one, you know, very, very few. This book, became very, very friendly with a man who unfortunately passed away a few years ago at the age of 97. And he and I became very friendly. He said, I'm going to set up a lunch for you. And I went to the lunch at his house, and there were six people there. I think I probably brought the average age down to about 89. And, you know, I came with a legal pad filled with questions, ready to go. We sat down, I asked the first question, and I didn't speak for the next 3 hours. It was incredible. These members of the Jewish community, both the Reform and the Conservative, and they just started talking to each other about that time. And it was as if they were transported back there, and I was there with them. And in fact, I stole one of the names. One of the crucial character in the book is the housekeeper for the Jesslers, the people he comes to live with. Her name is Mary Royal. Well, that was one of the names of one of these women's housekeepers. And I loved that touch of Royal. It was just wonderful because on some level, you mentioned that, you know, issues of racism come up. The African-American community on some level is the moral compass in this book for the simple reason that, you know, Yitzhak can't possibly understand what it is to be an African-American man, a black man living in the Jim Crow South. But he can certainly hear echoes of his own recent past and the way they're continuing to be treated, so much so that he begins to feel a greater affinity for the black community than even for his own family.
And more comfortable.
Well, I mean,
in some ways.
There's a moment where he's sort of driving down the street with this lovely young man named Raymond. And, you know, things happen to Raymond in the book. They're talking, and it just is very clear that Raymond is telling him, you know, next time, don't extend your hand to shake my hand. You know, just don't do that. And Yitzhak sort of sits back and thinks to himself, how easy is it to now be on the other side of this? I mean, it's just extraordinary. So he has to be able to see that experience, even though he obviously can't have known what it is to be living in the South as a black man at the time.
And to some extent, the book is about the fact that we can't really know what it's like to be anybody else.
No.
That everybody's experiences mean that we can't truly understand them.
Right. But even, yes, the Jews in Savannah can't possibly know what it is to, you know, to be. It's, we are alone on some level with those big ideas, and we have to process them ourselves, even though there are people around who you think, obviously those people will understand, but they can't. All they can do is open their arms and say, we're here. What else can we do? And on some level, Yitzhak begins to do that, as do the Jesslers, for the black community in Savannah, as best as they can, given the time. It's not perfect. This book doesn't end on a
little
bow. I mean, it's 1947 Savannah. I mean, one of the other things as I wrote the book, and I discovered this as I wrote the book, you know, growing up, I always knew about the relationship between the African-American community and the Jewish community during civil rights. It's both a positive and a troubling relationship and so forth, but it didn't just spring up. It had to have come from somewhere. So having a story that takes place in 1947, I needed to see if there were kernels of that beginning to bubble just beneath the surface, as I said, in Savannah. And I think there were between those two communities. But again, there were the limitations of the time.
So there's other resonances, certainly, to modern times. I mean, if you think about the state of not just racism, but look at the refugee crisis yeah. at this point. In what ways did you feel as though you were writing? I mean, you specialize in historical novels, and yet in a way, a successful historical novel needs to be timeless, right?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
How much is that in your head while you're writing?
It's a great question. I don't think those questions can be in your head. You have to, as a novelist, this is the difference between being a historian and being a novelist.
Yeah.
You know, as a novelist, I have to live in the moment with my characters. They have to make their choices. I tell my students, if you try and write about the big ideas, you know, this book is about identity and alienation, and so you'll bore the reader beyond measure, and you'll never get to what really makes characters human, what really makes the story, as you say, universal. You've got to deal with the moment to moment and the things that matter to them. I mean, history is the backdrop, but you're dealing with intimate lives, small lives, and those have to, you know, pulse with their own, what motivates them as individuals. Small choices. Do we go to this dinner? Do we not? At the same time, as you step back from the actual writing of the book and get more into, you know, the moments that you're away, you know, you do see these bigger ideas. But if you heavy pedal them too much, you become a pedant. You just are sort of up on your soapbox trying to teach people something, and they won't connect to it. They've got to connect to the individual characters. And then, hopefully, you know, the reader will put two and two together, and then you'll get that kind of resonance at the end of the book. I started writing this book, you know, 2-3 years ago. And even though this is still, you know, these issues still challenge us, it's really been in the last year and a half that things have exploded so much, especially in the news.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I didn't anticipate that. But these are issues that aren't going away. And I'm not going to say that I sat down and said, I'm going to write about this. But I don't think you can live in this country and not recognize that those are the issues that are there. And I don't, as I said, I didn't write a Holocaust book. I don't think I'm writing historical fiction. I know that sounds weird. But I think I found characters, I found a moment that makes sense to me. And it must make sense to me because of the moment that I'm living in. I mean, I'm not just going back to paint you a picture of something pretty in the past. I'm drawn to it because obviously I have concerns, my own anxieties about those issues. I just happen to find my characters in the moment in the past.
Jonathan Rabb is a professor of writing at SCAD and author of the book Among the Living. Rabb is both a featured writer and board member of the 2017 Savannah Book Festival this weekend. And that's our show for today, but as always, we want to hear from you. If you have a thought, call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OSTTalk, looking for your book recommendations. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.